started if we can. Goodness, it's a little loud today. So today we're going to talk about vaccines. Last time, you'll recall, we talked about how bacteria and viruses cause disease and how our immune system protects us from those types of infections. So we talked about the three levels of immunity. We talked about the barriers that your epithelium on your skin and your digestive and your respiratory tract, how they provide you with that first level of protection. And then we talked about the innate immune system, which is basically going to produce a nonspecific inflammatory reaction. The two components of that are the phagocytes that will try and engulf the pathogens and destroy them, and then complement, which will help target those invaders as pathogens that need to be destroyed by the phagocytes. And then finally, we spent the vast majority of our time talking about the adaptive immune system, which is a component of the immune system which provides you with immunologic memory. And we talked about the two types of immunologic memory, the antibody-mediated immunity and the cell-mediated immunity, and in particular, how important cell-mediated immunity was for providing protection against pathogens that had managed to invade cells. So in particular, when you have a virus that has managed to infect a host cell, cell-mediated immunity is very important in protecting you against that infection. And so where are we going to go from talking about pathogens and how they cause disease? We've talked about the immune system. Today what we're going to do is we're going to concentrate on understanding how vaccines work, how they provide us with protection against infectious disease, and we're going to take a look at the impact that vaccines have had, particularly in reducing childhood deaths due to infectious disease. Next time what we'll talk about is we'll talk about why it is so difficult to design a new vaccine to protect against HIV infection. There's one homework assignment that you'll have as part of the homework that's due next time, where you need to read an article which appeared originally in The New Yorker. It's written by one of my favorite science writers, Michael Spector, and it talks about some of the debate about carrying out clinical trials of HIV vaccines in Uganda. And we're actually going to do an activity in class for which you must have read this article for the activity to make any sense at all. And so we will be having a very short pop quiz at the beginning of class next time. Basically, I'm just going to ask you a couple of questions about the article. If you've read the article, it will be very easy to answer the questions on the pop quiz. So please read the article. It's an outstanding article. Okay. So again, today we're going to focus on how do we make vaccines, how do we go from the idea to a product with the vaccine, and what has been the societal impact of some vaccines. Just to give you a little of background to understand what are some of the differences that we have to take into account when we make vaccines to protect against different pathogens, I want you to recall how viruses cause infectious disease. Recall with the virus is going to use the host cell resources and the host cell machinery to reproduce and to make new copies of itself. It's not capable of doing that outside of a host cell. So a virus really has to do three things in order to be able to cause disease. The first thing it has to do is it has to be able to get inside a human cell and reproduce within the human cell. The second thing a virus has to do is it has to be able to spread from one person to another. Okay, and so there are a number of transmission mechanisms. We can have airborne transmission. We can have transmission that occurs when you eat food. We can have transmission that occurs during childbirth. And we looked at a number of viruses where that was the case. And we can have viruses that are transmitted during intimate physical contact. But there has to be a relatively efficient way of transmitting the virus from one person to another. And when we look at avian flu, for example, avian flu is capable of reproducing inside a human cell, but currently is not able to spread from another person to another person. And people are very, very worried that this virus will mutate and acquire that ability. Also, the virus has to acquire ways to evade the immune system. Okay? So if we look at influenza, what happens during an influenza infection? So the virus has to get inside the cell in order to be able to use the cell's biosynthetic machinery to reproduce. And typically what that means is that the virus will dock on a receptor that's found on the cell membrane. And then the viral particle will be endocytosed. So a piece of the cell membrane, a piece of the host cell membrane, will enclose the virus, and that will come into the cell as an endosome. And you'll remember last time we talked about how the pH in the endosome is going to be reduced, and that will break down this endosomal membrane and allow the virus to escape into the interior of the host cell. And somebody asked a question about how does the virus reduce the pH within the endosome? And it's actually interesting. I want to read a little bit about this. And it's actually not the virus that reduces the pH there. It's actually the membrane of the host cell that does that. And it's one of the ways that the host cell tries to degrade the contents of the endosome. So there's actually a proton pump that's contained in the membrane of the endosome. And that proton pump is going to pump hydrogen ions and reduce the pH inside the endosome. And viruses that are very efficient at infecting host cells are insensitive to the reductions in the pH. So they can survive the reductions in the pH and then escape the endosome and infect the host cell. Okay, so influenza virus, it'll bind to our cell, and that will induce receptor-mediated endocytosis. Okay, so the pH is going to get reduced in the endosome, and then the influenza virus can escape. It will release then its single-stranded RNA and the polymerase proteins that will allow the RNA to be transcribed into DNA. And then the host cell machinery will make copies of the viral RNA, copies of the viral coat proteins, and then we can bud new copies of the influenza virus out of the infected host cell. And so it's a process that actually looks very much like that process that we saw in HIV, right? One of the characteristics of the influenza virus is that nearly every virus that's produced in an influenza-infected cell is a mutant. And so the flu virus is very capable of this mutation. You see here, there are viral proteins that are inserted into the cell membrane of the cell that's been infected, and that's one of the ways that our cell-mediated immune system is going to recognize that this cell has been infected by virtue of these viral fragments of these viral proteins that are inserted into the MHC receptors on the surface of the infected cell. Okay. Now, how is influenza spread? It's spread primarily through airborne transmission. When an infected person sneezes on you or coughs on you, then you have all these micro droplets that contain viral particles. You breathe those in, and then you become infected. And so the influenza virus is going to target the epithelial cells that line your respiratory tract. Remember, we said that the respiratory tract lining is particularly susceptible to that infection. It's only a single cell layer thick. It doesn't have those multiple layers of dead cells that provide additional protection. Now, influenza only causes an acute infection, and the reason that that's true is that the virus basically kills the cells that it infects. It's going to cause those cells to lyse and die. Why do you get such symptoms associated with influenza? Well, your body is going to produce this general inflammatory response as a result of the infection. And so your body is going to produce large quantities of a substance called interferon. That's what makes you get the aches and the fever that come along with the flu. And it's also going to cause you to cough. You're trying to cough up all of the mucus that's produced as these these epithelial cells die that are lining your reproductive tract, and you have this very strong inflammatory reaction. So how does influenza avoid immune extinction? Why don't we all just become immune to the flu? We all get the flu. The way that it avoids this is by two phenomena. The first is called antigenic drift. So antigenic drift is this mutation that occurs as new copies of the flu virus are produced within your epithelial cells. As a result, we have different strains of the flu. We have these point mutations which occur. And so over time, we have sufficient changes in the genetic makeup of the flu virus so that if you caught the flu this year, you develop memory cells that will fight that particular strain of the virus. There is typically enough mutation that occurs that the strains that will circulate next year, your immune system will not recognize them. It will be different enough. Nonetheless, we still have yearly vaccination campaigns. How many of you got a flu shot this year? I got one. My daughter and my husband got the flu, and I was very glad I had gotten my flu shot. There's a lot of guesswork that goes into deciding which versions of the virus should we make the vaccine against, and typically a trivalent vaccine that protects against three different strains of the flu is what is produced. This is from the CDC website that shows weekly influenza activity, and you can see that there's widespread influenza present in the state of Texas right now. If you looked at this map a couple of weeks ago, Texas wasn't red. Texas was one of the blue states a couple of weeks ago. And so, in fact, in my daughter's class, there were 8 kids out with the flu today. Okay. I think we've said everything here. If you look at MMR weekly, mortality and morbidity reports weekly, if we scroll down here and we look at influenza, it'll tell us about how many people have died as a result of influenza. So here's influenza activity in the United States. And yeah, this is really interesting. This is how we decide if we're having a flu epidemic. And I think there's right here. Okay. So this looks at the percentage of deaths that are due to pneumonia and influenza as a function of time, okay? And you can see the seasonal variation in deaths due to influenza and to pneumonia. And so the bottom smooth curve, that is what is the expected mortality rate due to pneumonia and influenza. The line that jumps up and down, those are the observed death rates. And the higher smooth line is the threshold for when we have an epidemic of influenza. And so you can see right here in the early months of 2004, we had an influenza epidemic. You can see here's another one in the early months of 2005. And so this is how the CDC tracks and determines whether or not we've got an influenza epidemic present. Now, genetic shift is very different from genetic drift. Genetic drift occurs just as a result of these point mutations, and that's what's responsible for the slight variations from year to year in the strain of the influenza virus, which is producing most disease. Influenza virus has 8 genes, and we saw in the case of when bacteria acquire resistance to antibiotics, one of the things that bacteria can do is they can exchange genes or gene segments, and so they can transfer resistance to an antibiotic from one bacterium to another. Something similar can happen with the influenza virus. We can have viral gene segments reassociate between different strains of the flu virus. And so there are different types of influenza virus. that produce disease in different animal species, in birds and pigs, for example, and in humans. And we know that avian influenza, for example, can be easily transmitted from one chicken to another chicken, for example. It's now been observed in ducks. It can be transmitted from one duck to another, but it can't be transmitted easily from one person to another. And the big concern is that if we have a genetic shift in the influenza virus that will now allow the influenza virus to be easily transmitted from one person to another. So now rather than this point mutation that causes the genetic drift, we'll have a big genetic change, a genetic shift, and we'll produce a new strain of the flu virus that is capable of being easily transmitted from one person to another. We know that avian influenza has a very high mortality rate in people that it infects. It's been estimated to be between 40 and 75% mortality rate. So it's a very deadly version of the influenza virus. And so when we have people and different species of animals living in very close proximity, as we do, for example, in many parts of Asia, then it really is sort of the ideal conditions that can lead to the genetic shift that can cause a new and very deadly strain of flu virus. If you want to learn more about this, there's an interesting website on the CDC site, again, that talks about avian flu. And here we go, avian flu facts, infection in humans, and gives you really up-to-date information about the current situation and where we're seeing different types of avian influenza infecting different species of animals, birds, chickens, ducks, tigers, for example, as well as human cases. Okay. So with that background, what I want to do now is I want to think about how do we make vaccines to prevent disease with these pathogens. And basically, what we're going to do when we give a vaccine is we want to artificially induce immunity. So, you know, if you get chickenpox, for example, your adaptive immune system will now provide memory to protect you against future infections with varicella. What we want to do is we want to make a vaccine that will provide you with that same protection without having to undergo the symptoms of the disease. And our goal in vaccination is we want to stimulate both cell and antibody-mediated immunity that will protect us against future exposure to the pathogen. And we have to balance the danger that can be associated with the vaccination against we really want to create sort of the maximum realism so that your immune system will provide you with the memory to protect against future infection. And so what do we need to do to create this memory in your adaptive immune system? We talked about the two different types of immunity, and so to make the memory B cells that will ultimately produce antibody and to make memory helper T cells, all we have to do is we have to have the virus or viral debris outside of the cell, and we need B cell and T cell receptors to come into contact with that. If we want to make the memory killer T cells, however, the cells that present the antigen, they have to actually become infected with the virus and to place those pieces of the viral protein in their MHC receptors on the cell surface. And this is, as we'll see, harder to do. So we're going to take a look at four different types of vaccines that take different strategies to provide us with the memory in our immune system. And the four types of vaccines that we're going to look at, the first type is called a non-infectious vaccine. This is basically where we're going to take bacteria or part of a virus or a bacteria and we're going to kill it. So it's not capable of producing disease, and we're going to expose your immune system to that killed pathogen and we'll produce memory in your immune system. Second thing that we can do is we can make a type of vaccine called a live attenuated bacterial or viral vaccine. What we're going to do there is we're going to take the bacteria or the virus and we're going to modify it. We're not going to kill it, but we're going to modify it so that it doesn't produce symptoms of disease when you're exposed to it, but we have to have it be similar enough to the disease-producing pathogen that your immune system will recognize that. And then we can make what's called a carrier vaccine. There, we can take a virus that doesn't produce disease in humans, and we can use that to carry in a part of the virus that does produce disease in humans so that you'll be protected. And finally, we'll talk about DNA vaccines, and we'll actually spend much more time on Thursday talking about DNA vaccines, because many of the most exciting frontiers in making vaccines for HIV use DNA vaccines. So I want to focus today on the first three types of vaccines: non-infectious vaccines, viral vaccines, and the carrier vaccines. Okay. So as I said, with a non-infectious vaccine, basically what we're going to do is we're going to take bacteria that we've killed or virus that we have inactivated. There are a number of ways that we can do that. We can treat it with chemicals like formaldehyde. The danger with vaccines of this type is that you can't guarantee all the time that you've killed all of the pathogen. The Salk polio vaccine and the rabies vaccine are examples of non-infectious vaccines. Another type of non-infectious vaccine is called a subunit vaccine. Here you're going to take a part of a virus or use genetic engineering to make a protein that is part of a pathogen, and you're going to use that to vaccinate with. The advantage of this is that there's no danger that you will actually produce disease with this type of vaccine. And hepatitis A and B vaccines are examples of a subunit vaccine, as is the pneumococcal vaccine. I'm going to play a short video about that pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. I don't know what happened to our audio here. We had it before. Pneumococcus is a bacteria that causes meningitis, which is an infection of the brain. apologize that we're having such trouble with the audio. We're going to try and get it fixed. But the bottom line is that the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine uses a protein that's found on the surface of the pneumococcus and uses that to help the immune system recognize, to produce memory cells that will prevent against future infection. We talked about last time one of the ways that bacteria produce disease is to produce toxins, which will kill host cells. And so another type of non-infectious vaccine is called a toxoid vaccine. And here what's done is to take a bacterial toxin and modify it chemically to render it so that it's not going to kill host cells, but will still produce the memory cells that we need to fight future infection. And the DTaP vaccine is an example of a toxoid vaccine. And I'm going to hope we have better luck with the next video here.
The next vaccine that we're going to talk about is really three vaccines in one. Because we are able to easily combine these vaccines, children can get one shot instead of three.
Okay, so we'll hear later about pertussis outbreaks that resulted in deaths in the United States when the immunization rates to pertussis dipped below a certain threshold. So non-infectious vaccines are very, very safe vaccines. Because the non-infectious vaccines are just going to be present outside the host cells, they'll be very good at making memory B cells and memory helper T cells, but they won't make the memory killer T cells that are needed for cell-mediated immunity. As a result, with these type of vaccines to provide lifelong immunity, booster vaccines are typically needed. So the second type of vaccine that I want to talk about is the live attenuated vaccines. What we're going to do to make a live attenuated vaccine is we're going to take our pathogen and we're going to grow it in a host cell in a way that will reduce the pathogenicity so that it's not going to produce disease in healthy people, but it will still produce the immune response that will provide protection against future infection. Some examples of live attenuated vaccines include the oral polio vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella, and the chickenpox vaccine. And I have a short video about the chickenpox vaccine. The advantage of this approach is that because you've got a live pathogen, it's still capable of getting inside the host cells. And so we're going to make not only the memory B cells and the memory helper T cells, but we're also going to make the memory killer T cells that are necessary for that cell-mediated immunity. And so usually this approach will provide lifelong immunity. The one danger of this is we're going to weaken our pathogen so that it won't produce disease in healthy people. But if we have people who are immunocompromised because of HIV and AIDS or because of cancer, for example, the weakened pathogen can produce disease in those immunocompromised individuals. Okay. I'm going to skip this. It just gives a little bit more detail about how we grow the pathogen in cell culture to weaken it, because I'm afraid we're going to run out of time here. Okay. Now, the final approach that I want to talk about today is what's called a carrier vaccine, okay? With a carrier vaccine, what we're going to do is we're going to take a virus or a bacterium that doesn't produce disease in humans, and we're going to use that to carry viral genes to antigen-presenting cells. One example of a vaccine that uses this approach is the smallpox vaccine, where the carrier vaccinia is used. It's a pathogen that does not produce disease in humans, but can carry the smallpox genes to antigen-presenting cells. The advantage of this approach is that it will produce the memory B cells and the memory helper T cells, and it will also make the memory killer T cells. It doesn't pose danger of renal infection, again, in healthy people, although in immunocompromised individuals, it can produce disease. The carrier has to be one that we're not already immune to, and if we're going to give booster vaccines, we can't use the same carrier repeatedly. And we'll see that this is a challenge with HIV vaccines in class on Thursday. I just want to talk for a minute about DNA vaccines. We'll come back to DNA vaccines on Thursday. If we take the DNA that encodes for certain viral proteins and we just inject that into a host, for reasons that we don't fully understand, this will produce both memory B cells and memory killer T cells. We can use just a few viral genes to make these DNA vaccines, and we'll explore that in more detail when we talk about promising strategies for making vaccines against HIV. The advantage of this approach is that there really is no danger that it will cause infection, even in immunocompromised hosts, which is a big plus. So just to summarize, again, we have our non-infectious vaccines. The advantage of those is that they don't have the danger of infection. The disadvantage is that they don't fully stimulate cell-mediated immunity. Next type of vaccine we have is our live attenuated bacterial and viral vaccines. That will stimulate both antibody and cell-mediated immunity. The disadvantage is that if we have immunocompromised hosts, we can produce disease. And then finally, we have carrier vaccines. Those will produce both cell and antibody-mediated immunity, but they do pose the danger of infection in immunocompromised hosts who can become sick as a result of infection with the carrier. So these are our three main strategies that are used today. DNA vaccines are an important strategy for the future. So what I'd like to do now is I'd like to turn to take a look at the effectiveness of vaccines. First concept that I want to talk about is a concept called herd immunity. So if we take 20 people in this room and we vaccinate them, not all 20 of them will develop immunity against future exposure to the pathogen. It varies from vaccine to vaccine, but somewhere around 1 to 2 out of every 20 people will not have a completely adequate immune response to a vaccine. Yet, widespread vaccination has really reduced the incidence of infectious disease. And the reason is because it develops what's called herd immunity. And so if we vaccinate everybody in this room, they're going to develop antibodies against the pathogen. And so we're much less likely to be transmitting that pathogen. So even if we have only created immunity in 18 and 19 out of 20 people, those people are not going to get the disease, they're not going to be transmitting the pathogen. And various studies have shown that you have to have around 90 to 95% of your community to be vaccinated to provide that herd immunity. And when vaccination rates drop below that level, then you start to see outbreaks of infectious disease. And we'll see that that's the case with pertussis, for example, and several other infectious diseases. When these community immunization rates began to drop just down to 80 to 85%. Okay. Now, herd immunity isn't going to work against non-contagious diseases like tetanus, for example. You know, we've eliminated smallpox from the world. Can we ever eliminate tetanus from the world? No, we eliminated smallpox because we wiped it out in the carrier. Okay, but the tetanus bacterium lives in the soil. Okay. So I'd like to talk next about how vaccines are tested. If we develop a new vaccine, the first types of tests that are going to be carried out with that vaccine are called preclinical tests. We're going to test in the laboratory whether or not these vaccines are capable of producing an immune response. Most of those tests will be carried out in animal models. And for an animal model to be helpful to test a vaccine, we have to have an animal that is susceptible to infection by the agent against which our vaccine is directed. And ideally, the animals would show the same symptoms of disease that people would. Once we've shown that our vaccine appears to be safe and effective in animal models, then we can proceed to human clinical trials. And the human clinical trials are going to be carried out in 4 phases. The first phase, the phase 1 of a vaccine trial, is really just to determine, is the vaccine safe? It's not really to determine whether the vaccine is effective. And so we're going to take small numbers of volunteers, maybe 20 to 100 people. Typically, they'll be healthy adults, and we will watch them for a few months, and we will look at 2 things. We'll look at vaccine dosages that are going to produce antibody response, and we'll look at the side effects associated with the vaccine at these dosages. Before these phase one trials can be carried out, the FDA has to review the preclinical data that's been collected with that vaccine, and they have to issue a type of approval called an IND, or an investigational new drug approval. And I have a little clip from NPR about the first phase one trials of the vaccine to protect against Ebola. They're going to interview a nurse who was actually the first volunteer to test this vaccine.
Only went where no man
So there's an example of a phase one clinical trial of a vaccine. So if a vaccine makes it through a phase one clinical trial, and you heard him talk about they were going to look at lab results to see if he was mounting an immune response, if it does produce an immune response and there aren't side effects, then things can progress to a phase two trial. And in a phase two trial, you're going to have larger numbers of volunteers, maybe several hundred, and they will be divided into two groups, some of whom will get the new vaccine and some of whom will get either a placebo or an existing vaccine. And then they'll look at specific endpoints. Again, they'll look at safety as an endpoint, and they'll look at effectiveness of the vaccine as an endpoint. And then finally, a vaccine can move into phase three clinical trials. These will typically have several thousand volunteers. They might last years. And this will be a very special type of a trial called a controlled, randomized double-blind study, which means that some of the volunteers will get the vaccine, some will either get placebo or existing vaccine, and neither the patients nor the physicians will know who got the placebo and who got the new vaccine. And then we'll monitor again the endpoints of safety and effectiveness. And finally, then if a vaccine makes it through phase one, phase two, and phase three clinical trials, then the manufacturer can apply to the FDA to have the vaccine be licensed for use in the United States. Typically, it takes about a decade for a new vaccine to be licensed. And then once it is licensed, the company that makes the vaccine has to follow special rules when they manufacture it. So every lot of the vaccine has to be sampled for purity, for safety, and for potency. And a sample of that lot has to be sent to the FDA so that if any problems emerge with the vaccine, they can be traced to the specific lot that patients received. And that's all part of what's called post-licensure surveillance. So after a vaccine is licensed, post-licensure surveillance is sometimes called the phase four of testing of a vaccine. If a vaccine has very rare side effects that maybe occur only in one in every 10,000 or 20,000 patients, it might not be observed in the phase three clinical trials because it's such a rare side effect. And so physicians have to report any patients that have an adverse reaction to a vaccine, both to the FDA and to the CDC, through a system that's called the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. Typically in the US, they get about 12,000 reports per year, and maybe 2,000 of these are serious. Most of them turn out to be unrelated to the vaccine. I think I'm going to skip through this again because I've got some more NPR clips that I want to play. This is the vaccine schedule that's currently recommended in the United States. So you can see all of the shots that children must receive as part of their childhood immunization. Sometimes your kid has to get up to 5 shots at a single visit. And so it can be something that is traumatic both for children and for their parents. Here's the recommended schedule in the U.S. right now. So I talked about post-licensure surveillance. And we talked a little bit about the rotavirus vaccine and how it was withdrawn from the market after post-licensure surveillance indicated some very rare but serious complications. My son actually developed a very serious case of rotavirus just before the vaccine became available. And so when we were listening to the whole history of the rotavirus vaccine and the news of the very serious, sometimes fatal complications was emerging, you know, for me it really brought home the worry that parents can feel about the safety of childhood vaccination. So I want to play you two stories. The first story talks about the complications that were identified, and the second story talks about a new version of the rotavirus vaccine, which is now available and doesn't have these complications. So here we're going to go back. Do I have the right one? No, I don't. Let's talk about some of the ethical dilemmas associated with the vaccine that did have the complications. So they talked about the number of children that die worldwide as a result of rotavirus, 600,000. And at the time, there was a lot of debate in the international community about, could you give a vaccine that might result in death in 1,000 who was vaccinated if it was going to save far more lives by preventing rotavirus? Ultimately, that vaccine was not commercialized, was not distributed. But more recently, there is a vaccine available which does not appear to have those same side effects. And it was just announced, this is from January of 2006. This was a story that was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine.
For many people, I believe this is all things considered. I'm not a placebo.
And I'm Michelle Dorris. Today, researchers announced the results of the largest vaccine trials in children since the polio vaccine studies in the 1950s. Two new vaccines prevent severe diarrhea caused by a common germ called rotavirus. An unlike rotavirus vaccine marketed briefly in the late 1990s, the new vaccines appear safe. As NPR's Richard Knox reports, manufacturers and public health experts now have to figure out how to get the vaccines to children all over the world.
Rotavirus isn't exactly a household word, but Dr. Roger Glass, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says rotavirus does afflict virtually every household where young children live.
Rotavirus is the most common cause of severe diarrheal disease in children worldwide. Every child is infected in their first few years of life. And globally, more than 600,000 children die of rotavirus each year.
Only about 70 American children die of rotavirus infection each year, but around 70,000 get hospitalized. Many thousands more end up in doctor's offices and emergency rooms. Dr. Penny Eaton is a vaccine researcher at Merck and Company.
If you think about a virus that affects all children and causes an illness of vomiting and diarrhea that lasts on average 6 days,
Eaton ran one of the two rotavirus vaccine studies being published in this week's New England Journal of Medicine. Merck tested its vaccine against a placebo in 68,000 American and European infants.
The vaccine prevented 74% of any rotavirus illness and then 98% of severe disease.
The other... Three top editors in 11 Latin American countries and Finland participated. That vaccine was 85% effective in preventing severe rotavirus infections. Neither vaccine caused a potentially life-threatening disorder called intussusception. Back in 1999, an earlier rotavirus vaccine was pulled from the market after some U.S. children suffered from a painful bowel obstruction. Dr. Miguel Orion of the University of Chile in Santiago says the new study represents a landmark in childhood vaccine development.
I think that we can very happy to say that last now 2006 we have two new vaccines for youth and children worldwide after more than 20 years of that.
I don't know if we're going to get it back or not, but I think we've gotten the main point. So they said a couple of interesting things. They said that these vaccine trials were the largest trials since the test of the polio vaccine. They tested 130,000 children. Why do you think they tested such a large group of children? Exactly. There's a lot of concern that this vaccine would have similar serious side effects, which might be very, very rare. If they're only going to affect one child in 20,000, for example, then you need to have a much larger group of children to test to determine whether or not those rare but serious side effects are present. The other thing that they talked about was the effectiveness of the vaccines. They said that one vaccine was 74% effective in preventing any kind of rotaviral infection. The other vaccine was 85% effective. And really with herd immunity again, then we do have the potential to really reduce, if not eliminate, the rotavirus infection through vaccination. Okay. All right. I'm going to skip through some of the stuff on the history of vaccination. You can read about it. What I did want to do is get to this table. This table shows the effect that vaccination in the United States has had in reducing the number of cases of infectious disease. And so what's shown here is the type of disease. This is the maximum number of cases that occurred in 1 year, and this is the year that those cases occurred. And here are the number of cases of that disease that occurred in the year 2000, and this is the percentage change. And so you can see for most of these, the number of cases of disease have decreased by over 85% as a result of vaccination. diphtheria gone from 200,000 to 2 in 2000, measles from 900,000 to 60. Pertussis is an interesting one. We'll come back to pertussis next time. But for all of these diseases, we've seen very, very dramatic reductions in the number of cases per year as a result of vaccination. Smallpox is the first human disease to be eradicated from the world as a result of a global immunization campaign. It's sort of an interesting story to look back at the history of the smallpox vaccination campaign. If we go back to 1974, at that time, only 5% of the world's children received the 6 vaccines which were recommended by the WHO. And in the 20 years since that time, the number went from only 5% to more than 80% of the world's children receiving these 6 basic vaccines, really as a result of international health efforts. And as a result now, 3 million lives are saved every year due to vaccination. The vaccine for smallpox became available in the early 1800s. At that time, it was difficult to keep the vaccine viable enough to deliver to developing countries. In the 1950s, there were a number of technical advances that were made in the vaccine production. They could make a stable freeze-dried vaccine. And so with that advance in 1950, there was the goal to eradicate smallpox first from the Western Hemisphere. In 1967, that goal was achieved, except for Brazil. Based on the success, in 1959, a goal was set to eradicate smallpox from the world. And really, in the decade following, there was very little progress made until a number of resources were dedicated to worldwide vaccination campaigns. And really, the strategy to eliminate smallpox was to achieve worldwide vaccination rates of more than 80%. And to follow that, to surveil for outbreaks, and whenever an outbreak was observed, to go in and to vaccinate the population in that region. And so in 1980, the goal of eliminating smallpox from the world was achieved. I talked about the basic immunizations that are recommended by the WHO. And in 1977, the WHO set the goal of achieving vaccination rates of at least 80% by 1990. And this is a really nice graph. This shows cases of measles and pertussis that were reported to the WHO between that period of 1974. Remember, at that time, only 5% of the world's children were receiving vaccines. And by 1994, we had reached the 80% levels. And you can see the very dramatic decline in the cases both of measles and of pertussis. This is looking at cases of diphtheria reported to the WHO over that same time period, going from 1974 now on out to 2000. And the gray bars, the darker bars, represent European cases of diphtheria. And here we have worldwide cases of diphtheria. What do you think happened here? Immunization rates dropped and we lost herd immunity. And so we had outbreaks of diphtheria. Okay, and we can see these very, very real consequences when we lose that herd immunity. And we'll talk about that again with pertussis, with outbreaks that happened in Philadelphia. Here I want to show you, this is again now reported measles cases as a function of time. And here we're looking at the routine immunization coverage. And so you can see the coverage starting out in 1980 at about 50%. Here we reached 80%. And you can see when you reach that 80% level, the big drop off in the number of cases of measles when we achieve that herd immunity. I'm going to play just one last NPR clip. This is about a measles immunization campaign in Africa. give it one more try. Guess we have the dysfunctional information technology at Rice University to thank this morning. It's a really great story. If we can't get it, you should listen to it. It's really interesting, some of the cultural barriers to vaccination. I think I have to give up here. Listen to this one. It's very interesting to contrast the story about Africa to this one about the United States.
About 20% of American preschool children are not getting all the vaccinations the government recommends. At least more than 2 million children each year are vulnerable to diseases like measles, whooping cough, and hepatitis B. Part of the problem here is the difficulty in obtaining free vaccines. But new research suggests the toughest obstacle may be parents. Some believe vaccines are more dangerous than the diseases they prevent. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
The latest government figures show that childhood vaccination rates are at an all-time high. Vaccination advocates weren't celebrating during a press briefing yesterday. Shelley Hearn is the executive director of Plus for America's Health.
Neglecting to vaccinate those over 2 billion preschool kids on time each year is just not okay. It's not a lost cause. We could make very real changes very fast by taking some very real and simple steps.
The briefing was held to release a new report on vaccination from Hearn's group and another nonprofit called Every Child by Two. The report proposes several ways to increase vaccination rates. One is to make it easier for children without good health insurance to obtain pre-vaccines. Dr. Samuel Katz of Duke University says another avenue.
You have your children in New York City and they're immunized or not, and then you move to Tucson, Arizona, and you may not have your records with you to show to the new physician in Tucson.
When that happens, a child may skip a vaccination. Pat says low immunization rates stem more from a lack of organization than a lack of money. After all, he says, developing countries like Vietnam, Malawi, and Bangladesh have measles vaccination rates higher than 90%.
On the other hand, Germany, France, Italy, Japan, among the wealthiest countries in the world, have some of the poorest levels of immunization.
Kat says that's partly because many parents in wealthy thinking has led to repeated outbreaks in the U.S. of diseases that should have disappeared long ago, diseases like measles.
We had our last big epidemic in 1991. We had about 55,000 cases of measles. We had several hundred deaths. So it's not a trivial disease when it occurs.
Another reason parents don't get their children immunized is the fear that some vaccines could trigger developmental problems, like autism. Stories about this supposed risk persist despite several large studies that have found no link between vaccines and autism. Yet even an unsubstantiated vaccine scare can reduce vaccination rates for a long time. That's the finding of a new study by Chris Bao with the University of Guelph in Ontario.
Well, I think we've lost it. Yeah, it goes on to talk about the diphtheria outbreak that we saw in Europe that was preceded by a scare about the safety of the vaccine. And one of the points I think that this article is trying to make is that when our incidence rates drop so low for these very serious infectious diseases that can result in death, like measles, for example, why is it that our immunization rates are lower than those of Vietnam? We don't remember how serious a disease measles can be. We haven't seen people die as a result of measles. And so somehow then, psychologically, the danger of the vaccine seems to be greater than the danger of the disease. And when those immunization rates dip below that 80%, then we begin to see outbreaks and deaths as a result. Okay, I just want to leave you with what vaccines are still needed. The big three that are still needed: HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis, all diseases that we've talked about that still result in a large number of deaths worldwide. So in summary, we've talked about how vaccines work, how vaccines are made, and how vaccines are tested. What we're going to do next time is we're going to take a look at some of the challenges associated with making an HIV vaccine, and we're going to look at some of the ethical dilemmas associated with testing those vaccines. So please be sure to read the Michael Spector article in preparation for class on Thursday.